Today is Friday, August 27, 2021. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Williams. That's James David Williams. Goes by Jim, common spelling, last name. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Good afternoon.
Glad to hear it. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you have my permission.
Thank you very much. Jim, we left off at the end of part one. You were completing your second master's, this one in biology, in 1965. You and your wife, Ann, and your son, James Jr., you were going to the University of Alabama, and your plan at the time was to then move on to a PhD.
Yep.
At the end of your master's thesis, 1965, of that second degree, were you still thinking to get a PhD?
Yes, I was probably more committed than ever at that point because I had so thoroughly enjoyed the master's research that I did, and I had all these ideas for other things to work on, and I was really focused on proceeding with a PhD immediately. Yeah.
Was 1965 a good time for the study of fish? Were there a lot of opportunities opening up and things to study?
In 1965 it was. There was a lot of interest building for conservation, and at the same time a lot of interest in aquatics in the southeast because it was a relatively unknown sort of group, really. There had not been a lot of focus except for the fish culture and farm ponds and the management of game fish, and that's everything was oriented towards those fields. And then all of a sudden in the 60s there was a lot of interest through ichthyologists at a bunch of different universities in the southeast, and so yeah, things were really opening up in 1965.
So when I think of the early 60s, I think of rivers on fire and just a lot of pollution, but I kind of think a lot of that might have been happening up in the northeast. Was that happening in the south as well?
Ours is more pollution from inadequate wastewater treatment plants. We had a lot of system streams that just were totally dead from either municipal waste or industrial waste that was being dumped in because it was not regulated.
Okay.
There was no EPA, there was no Clean Water Act, there was no Departments of Environmental Management. And there was in Alabama in the 60s, I guess, something called a Water Improvement Commission that was formed kind of out of desperation because there were a lot of places that were just so polluted it was killing everything.
Oh, wow.
And again, I see the 60s as a transition period where things were beginning to get a little bit better because the states were realizing, hey, wait, this is a mess. And part of it was it's a health hazard. I mean, it was that filthy.
I would think that would be a tough time, actually, to study ichthyology, just given the poor water quality.
Well, it was actually a lot of the pollution was point source pollution, which means you've got a pipe going into the river, and the river eventually recovers, and I guess the pipes were spaced widely enough that you didn't have a complete kill of the river. So
okay.
There were still clean areas, and especially where you had a lot of rural areas away from cities like Birmingham or Montgomery and places that had Birmingham was just a mess. And also, at that same time, there was a lot of mining that was opening up.
Oh.
Yeah, coal mining.
Okay. Was this the mountain, the start of the mountaintop removal, or was this still underground stuff?
It wasn't mountaintop, but it was pretty dirty.
Okay.
There were places where they could basically rip off a few feet of overburden and get it a cold seam, and that's what they did.
Oh, I see.
And,
wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right. So, in 1965, I'm sort of thinking, you know, the world is your oyster. You must have had the potential to go to a number of different programs for a PhD. Where did you go, and why did you decide to go there?
Okay, I decided to stay at the University of Alabama.
Oh.
And the reason I did was from the time I got there and started working on my bachelor's degree in 1962 to 65, there had been a whopping change in faculty. Plus, there had been tons of new faculty members added. And so the department looked nothing like it did when I started in 1960.
Hmm.
And even in 63, when I was working on my master's in education, taking a couple of classes. So there was a lot of change. And the other thing was I actually talked to a couple of other universities, Florida State I talked to, and I briefly considered moving across the state to Auburn, but fortunately I decided against that.
Okay.
But it was Florida State and Auburn were probably the only other two that I really considered and did talk to people there. But I had a family, and I was so set up, and it was like I just kept cranking from
okay.
one to the other.
Okay.
It was almost like seamless. I finished up in August of 65 and started on my PhD in September 65 and just kept going. So, yeah.
Okay. And then, again, looking at where you were at the time, I would assume there would be any number of different interesting things to look into in a PhD program. What did you decide on to study, and why did you choose that?
Well, you're right. There were tons of things to work on, and my problem was trying to narrow my focus down and take something that I wouldn't have a problem with it getting away from me and going off into the woods, so to speak, or in the ditch. And I was really interested in darters. Darters are a group of freshwater fishes. They belong to the perch family, Perchidae, P-E-R-C-I-D-A-E, Perchidae. And darters are called darters because they have no gas bladder, so they sit on the bottom, and they dart around to pick up food. That's the name, darters.
Okay.
And there's three genera. There's Ethiostoma, Persina, and Amacrypta. And Persina and Ethiostoma they're much larger genera. They large numbers of species, a lot of diversity. So the one genus that was small was Amacrypta. At the time, it only had four or five species. So I thought, well, I could take that on. But they ranged all the way from the upper Mississippi River and Great Lakes area all the way to Texas to Alabama. So they're widespread.
Big range.
Yeah. And so you look at that, and I started looking at some of them. I thought, this looks really different from this one over here. So I thought, I think there are probably some undescribed species in here.
Hmm.
So that's when I started working on them. And,
okay.
So my dissertation was on the taxonomy systematics of the genus Amocrypta, Amocrypta.
Okay.
And so, that was the fact that I had generic boundaries. Let me back up. At the time, there was a species that some people recognized as being an Amocrypta, and some people said, no, it's not Amocrypta, it's in a different genus unto itself, Crystallaria. And so I wound up doing, most people recognize it as Amocrypta, but I wound up doing the subgenus Amocrypta, which had all these five or six species that were widespread, the genus, which had Crystallaria in it, and it's now separate. So what I did my dissertation on is basically the genus Amacrypta today. So.
Okay. You know, today I think about the gene, so the whole DNA sequencing, you know, all of the stuff that we can do to really zone in tightly on species and speciation. How were you doing it back in 1965 to figure out what was different from another and on the species level?
Yeah, that's, I was just at the very, when I finished up molecular techniques, electrophoresis back then, was just coming into focus. But it was too late for me to get into it with my, because I didn't have the live material or fresh material that I would need to do that. But I did pretty much the classical taxonomic methods at that time, which were based on morphology and color.
Okay.
So I counted scales and I measured fins and body parts and ran the statistics on it. And what that required was visiting museums pretty much all over the country and borrowing tons of material from others I didn't visit to fill in the geography of these things, so I knew exactly how much variation there was, or difference there was, say, between the Ohio River Basin of this thing and the upper mist of the same species.
Okay.
And so you have to work these out by basins, pretty much. And, yeah, that was... I don't know how many thousands of specimens I counted. I scaled and measured. Well, I didn't measure that many, but I counted scales on an awful lot of them. And it came down to, in some cases, color being a really good character to separate some of these things.
Oh, interesting.
And, so, yeah. And it's mainly the banding pattern of the fins and the coloration on the body.
Okay.
That helps sort them out.
And when I think of fish work, I think of electrofishing, where there's a DC generator and a positive electrode and a negative electrode, and you drop them into the water, and the fish get drug over to one end, and you can scoop them up. With little fish like this, little darters, you didn't electric. Were you saning them? How did you get them out of the water?
It was all done with just common minocenes.
Okay.
What I did for Amacrypta, because they're called sand darters, but basically they make their living by burrowing into the sand head first.
Okay.
And then when they wiggle out, they've got just the snout and the eyes exposed.
Wow.
And they're sitting out there on a sandbar, which is not a very productive habitat.
Right.
If you think about it, there's not much lives there because you've got these sand grains rolling along. But when you get midge larvae, things like that are drifting.
Okay.
And when they've got fairly large eyes, and when they see something go by, they dart out and grab it. And
then they run back to cover, lest some other
fish
come after them.
Right.
And because they're in a ripply kind of sandy environment, they wouldn't necessarily be where the eddy line fish were feeding that might eat them.
Right. It's a pretty sandbars are just generally pretty sterile environments because nothing's growing there.
Yeah.
So because it's a shifting, moving habitat.
Yes. And they would have to shift. They would have to dig a new little burrow and.
Yep.
Hang out for a while.
They don't build anything in the way of burrow. They just dive head first into the sand.
Oh, really? They kind of push in and pop up and
push in.
Huh.
They wiggle their bodies laterally and build this burrow right in. And they'll pop out. And I collected a bunch of them to watch them do this. And I was trying to get an idea of how deep they were going into the sand.
Uh-huh.
And just lying there with a snorkeling mask on and taking one out of the bucket and turning it loose on the sand and watching what it did.
Hmm.
And And one of the things I found was the water temperature in the stream might be fairly warm, but, it might be, say, 75, but it was always a degree or two cooler just a few millimeters into the sand, because you've got groundwater in there that's not exposed to the light.
Okay.
And it's not an air, so it's not moving. So,
right.
So then the body's in some fairly cool water, even though the head and eyes are poking out up there in the warmer water. But, it's a fairly, bass will drift by on things that would play on darters. But
okay.
They just don't hang out over sandbars. I mean, they know better. There's nothing there.
Wow, that's quite a fascinating little niche.
It's a really interesting group of fishes, yeah.
Huh.
It really is.
And they're about an inch and a half, 2 inches long as adults?
Two and a half inches, yeah.
Okay, all right. And so what did you discover? What did you find out about them?
Well, we found that there's actually, on the Gulf Coast, there's this one species that was thought to be native from the Chokachee River in Florida and Alabama, west to about the Pearl, Pascagoula, maybe like Pontchartrain ranges. So that was one species, yeah, and that's Hemicrypta beani. And that one turned out to be two different things instead of one. And that was one of the things that sort of clued me in. It got me into this project to begin with, was I'd collected a bunch of these things in these isolated coastal drainages, and when I picked them up, I noticed they had dark bands on the margins of the fin. And the ones that I was used to picking up around Tuscaloosa University in West Alabama did not have a band, a marginal band. And so that was one of the first things that clued me in that this might be a good group of fish to work on for my PhD.
Okay.
So so that was one new species there. Then there's another species that occurred in Mobile Basin that was thought to be closely related to something out in Texas, and that Hemicrypta vivax, and that goes from Texas east to the Pearl Pascagoula rivers in Mississippi, and then in the Mobile Basin it was supposed to be vivax, but that's V-I-V-A-X. But it was not vivax, it's something different. And this is an enigma that we still are wrestling over right now with molecular techniques. Based on morphology, that fish that everybody had been calling vivax in the Mobile Basin was supposed to be sister to vivax out in Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi. But based on my morphology studies, it looked more like something that was in the Ohio Basin and Great Lakes. So my idea was that this thing was at one time pushed south during glacial periods. It got isolated in the Mobile Basin, and vivax was over there in Texas at the time, and it has since spread over to Mississippi. But this thing in Alabama is not vivax. It's not related to vivax. But now, when you do genetic analysis on them, it turns out that somewhere along the way, I think there's been hybridization.
Okay.
And some of the genetic gene pool from the vivax has gotten into this thing in the Mobile Basin, because it clearly comes out genetically that way, but morphologically, it does not. I mean, it's clear that it's related to the thing in the Great Lakes and Ohio Basin.
Okay.
So, we're still racking with that one. So,
wow.
Even though I finished my dissertation 50 years ago almost, almost 50 years ago, good Lord. And it's like, I still have a question I haven't answered yet.
Well, I bet.
But it's the more genetic data we get on it, the more we understand how some of these things may have arrived at where they are today through either some crossing, back crossing. crossing, hybridization, mixing. So it's a fascinating problem, and we see the same thing in other groups of animals. And I've seen some in freshwater mussels, but there it's more difficult to sort out because you don't have all these nice morphological characters that you have in vertebrates. Scales and fin rays and body parts that you can actually, you know, evaluate. Whereas mussels, it's like, not much there.
So who was your major professor, and who inspired you most as a professor during your PhD, and why or how?
Well, that would be Dr. Herbert T. Boschung, B-O-S-C-H-U-N-G, and fondly referred to as Dr. Bo.
Okay.
But Bo was, he was the guy that flipped me from botany over to field zoology and ichthyology. My last semester of my undergraduate work. And then I did my master's under him, and then I continued on with my PhD under him. But he was, the thing I really liked about him was he gave you freedom.
Okay.
He let you go down these roads, and sometimes he'd say, you know, Jim, I'm not too sure about that one. And I'd sat there and worked on it in the evenings, weekends, for 2 months. And it's like, yep, you're right, Bo. There's nothing here. I think he knew it all the time, but he wasn't going to tell me that.
Uh-huh.
You know, and by, it's a process of learning by looking at all these fish and looking at it and saying, well, I think they're different. But then you do all this work and you realize, no, it's not. This is just another range of variation here we're seeing, and this river system is over here, and it's not anything to get excited about. And then you move on, but it's a process of learning.
Okay.
But he was also just, he was enough of a mentor, but he believed in working hard.
Okay.
And he believed in having fun. So he made it enjoyable.
And, fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
how would he inject fun into hard work?
It was frequently, I think part of it was he had a sense of humor and played practical jokes. Like we had this dartboard in the lab, and there was a drugstore across parking lot in the highway or road through the middle of campus that we were right on the edge of campus. And this drugstore had a counter in it that you could buy hamburgers, and they had a couple of booths and whatever.
Okay.
And tables. And we'd go over there, usually mid-morning, if we didn't have a class at 10 o'clock. We'd go over there and have a quick cup of coffee and come back. And it was a chance to, you know, throw ideas out, bounce ideas off of one another and whatever.
Nice.
We'd go over there with Bo, and he'd frequently round a coffee for us or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was all of 10 cents a cup then, I think about it. I go to Starbucks, and it's $4. But anyway,
yeah.
We had this dartboard in the lab, and so if Bo wasn't going, or even if he was going, if he was around, we'd throw darts to see who was going to buy the coffee that day.
Okay.
And so Bo happened to walk up there one morning. He'd just gotten out of class and at 10 o'clock, and we were already getting ready to throw darts, and he said, well, I'll just tell you, I am so good at darts, you just wouldn't believe. He said, I'll bet you a little side bet over here, if any of you want to take me up on it, I'll bet you $1. And I thought, that's 10 cups of coffee, you know. And he said, I'm going to put a side bet on this, and I can put I can hit the bullseye with my left hand.
Wow.
And Charles Tucker, one of the grad students, said, well, what kind of odds you got? He said, well, I'll do 10 to 1 odds. And so Charles puts his dime on the table, and Bo puts his dollar bill down. And so what he does, he takes his arm, his left hand, and he walks up there and just sticks it right in the bullseye. And Charles says, "You're cheating. You didn't throw the dart." He said, "Well, I just said I was going to put the dart in the bullseye with my left hand." And Charles says, "I'm telling you, you're not taking my dime. I'm getting my dime back." And it's like we're all sitting around just thinking it's funny as hell. And probably one of the best ones he ever pulled, he sat around in the faculty lounge and was talking about he shot a little pool in his day. He's pretty good at it. And there's this one professor that wanted to challenge him. He said, "Well, let's go down to the pool. If you think you're pretty good, I bet you I can shoot pool. I'm damn good. I know I can do it better than you can." And then, so it got to be this, this contentious thing. And Bo, he had this way of letting things ride for a couple of days, and then it would just sort of bubble back up to the surface. And so the time came when he's like, "Okay, we're just going to have to go down here to the pool hall on the strip in University Avenue and settle this one day at lunch." And so this other professor says, "That sounds like a good idea. I think we should do that." So I'm thinking, I've seen Bo shoot pool, but he's not that great.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, "Damn, Bo, you might have bit off more than you can chew here, dude." So we go down to the pool hall, and by this time, the grad students, Bo students, had started making little side bets with this other professor's grad student. I mean, it got to be a big deal. Well, we go in the pool hall, and Bo goes back corner table and picks him out a cue, and he starts chalking it up. And the owner of the pool hall comes out and says, "Damn it, I told you never come back in here. You'd hustle the last person in here. Get the hell out of my pool hall," and talking to Bo. And then the other professor's like, "What? I'm not getting hustled in here. I'm not bad. I'm out of here. And Bo says, "We'll go to another pool hall." No, I'm not doing this. Oh, no. And Bo had basically baited him in, and this guy had taken him up on it, but he probably was a better pool shooter than Bo.
Huh.
But it turns out, and Bo didn't tell us this till a couple years later,
uh-huh,
before it came out. The guy that owned the pool hall was a good friend of his.
Okay.
And he called him up and said, "Look, today's the day. We're about to leave to come down to the pool hall," and said, "Well, I get in there now. You better come over and bail me out. take the cue away from me and throw me out of the pool hall." And God, we're all looking at this. God damn, he's a pool hustler. We had no idea.
What a very clever man.
Yeah,
very clever.
He was always the other funny thing he used to do on the first day of class in a big lecture hall in general zoology. The blackboard went all the way across the front of the lecture room. I mean, this room held like 100, 125 students, something
okay.
like that. And it's one of those tiered lecture halls and big table down front and blackboards all the way across. Well, the blackboards were ancient, but they had been put up with small nails. And one of those nails had wriggled out of the seam in the blackboard and stuck out just about a quarter of an inch. But you couldn't see that from the the front row even. I mean,
right.
it looked like a blackboard.
Right.
So he would go in the first day of class and welcome class. This is general zoology, whatever. And he wore this like golfer's hat, like a Ben Hogan golf hat. The little small bills and woolen hat.
Okay.
I don't know what you call those, but that was his hat. And let's see, I need to get started here. I need to take my hat off. And he turned around and he drew this nail on the blackboard so that the head of it came out right where that nail had wiggled out of the chalkboard.
Uh-huh.
And he hangs his hat on this nail that he just drew on the blackboard.
Wow. He's
like, "Whoa, that's pretty good." So that got their attention.
Oh, that's fun.
But, we used to stand outside the door and sort of watch this and see the guests. Like, "Whoa, they're looking at each other like, How the hell do you do that? What's going on with this guy? Probably should listen to him. He might be saying something we should hear.
Oh, that's fun.
But, yeah, Bo was just, I love the guy. And after I graduated in 69, he and I would attend professional meetings, usually the American Society of Ichthyologists and Herpetologists, or the Association of Southeastern Biologists meetings at the time. And basically, we always shared a room together. There was never any question. And we'd always split the room, 50-50, but we always got a room and shared a room. And that was, everybody knew that there was going to be a party, and Bo and Jim's room. And so, yeah, and there was even a season where the presentation of the bird took place. And presentation of the bird was a bottle of wild turkey. And it was a bet that Bo made with Dr. David Ettenier, E-T-N-I-E-R, at the University of Tennessee, ichthyologist. And both of them love football. And it was just a bet every year on straight up. No points, no question about it. So you just knew every year that there was a bet on the Alabama-Tennessee game.
Okay.
And it would be paid off with a half-gallon jug of wild turkey at the ASB meeting the following spring.
Okay.
So that was, it was called the presentation of the bird. Always a speech. Always a speech given before a presentation of the bird by both Bo and by Etz. And the two of them were just the greatest of friends and spent a lot of time together.
Oh, fun.
After they retired. And, but yeah, Bo passed away a few years ago, and Etz is still living. And he slowed down a little bit, but he's still goes into UT and works on aquatic insects. So he still goes in, does some work on aquatic insects. And but yeah, it was one of these things that there was Southeastern Ichthyologists was a really tight knit group, and we all had fun, but we all were very serious about our work, and we worked our butts off. And none of us knew, this is especially in grad school, knew nothing about weekends or evenings. It's like, it didn't matter. You just worked. But you wanted to work because it was fun. And
did you meet Bo when you were working on your master's?
Yes.
Okay, so that would have that right alone, what you've said about the man, might have been enough to answer my question of why you just went right into the PhD program without batting an eye.
I actually did, because a couple of professors said, well, you know, the department's changed a lot, but it's always sort of best. At that time, you didn't want to get your master's and PhD at the same institution. It was just sort of unwritten rule, you don't do that. But a couple of professors that I talked to said, you know, you're going to be taking classes with these young professors that for your PhD that you've never had before. And Bo's the only sort of really strong connecting link between the past and the future here. So, but I did, as I said, I actually talked to a professor at Auburn. And, but boy, the more I talked to him, he was more wanting to steer me towards management, fish management, rather than fish biology and true ichthyology, study of fishes rather than, Auburn's an applied school. So they taught management courses and applied sciences. And Alabama's always been known as the science, pure science. School, you do research for the sake of knowledge, and so I never really considered anything other than Alabama seriously, but I did sort of look around,
okay,
just to see what was there.
And during this time, the Vietnam War was going.
How did
you deal with the draft and that issue, because you would have been draftable?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a deferment.
Okay.
For grad school.
Okay.
And the other thing was, The draft board that I'd signed up with was in Brunswick, Georgia, and they had a large pool of draftees to pick from.
Oh.
And I was at the back of the line because I had a student deferment, and I was married, and I had a kid. So
got that, it. Okay.
That basically. But at the same time, we had a lot of single male students that sweated bullets, no pun intended, that, in fact, one did sign up. But he joined so he could have a little say in where he was going, what he was doing.
Hmm.
And he wound up in the at Aberdeen Proving Grounds in Maryland, working in the biochemical labs. They were doing some testing then on gases and how to prevent toxic gases from, you know, if they were ever used by some bad group of people. Hmm. You never knew.
Right.
But they were doing all sorts of tests on everything. And they were looking at things in water that might, you know, how some enemy might actually poison the water and supply or whatever. But, yeah, that was the one individual that, and there was actually a couple of others that got selected, but it was right towards the end, and they didn't wind up going. Hmm. But it was a huge issue. I mean,
okay.
That was really, whew.
Yeah.
But
as you say, you know, married with child, working on a PhD, that puts you.
And put me at the back of the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I actually, somewhere along in there, I turned 26, which was at that time a cutoff for draftable age.
Okay.
So I was born in 41, 51, 61.
Right, would have been 60.
66.
66. 67, that's right. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah. So I do remember going drinking the night that I turned 26, and there was a ceremonial burning of the draft card because I could do that because I was no longer a draftable age. I was an old man already.
Right, right.
And so, yeah. But, you know, one of the things I'm at the, not knowing hours during the graduate years and working all the time, I guess it was about 66. I've been working on a PhD for a year, and the NASA to infuse money into sciences and universities,
right,
sponsored all these what they call traineeships, which were basically scholarships, and they usually put like at Alabama, I think there was like 5 in engineering and 5 in chemistry. But they always had a couple, 1 or 2 in biology. And Bo, without my knowledge, had put me in for one. And he had basically, you know, they made recommendations. I guess you had to do a little write-up why this would be a good candidate, whatever.
Okay.
He did.
Uh-huh.
And so somewhere along in there, I was only for 3 years, so it would have been 69, 68. 66, I guess. I got a NASA traineeship.
Wow.
And what that meant was that I no longer had to teach the general biology labs because that's how I had no tuition fees because I was working as basically a teacher.
Right. So you're doing the
lab, teaching labs to pay for it.
Right.
And on top of that, you got a small stipend. And,
nice, yeah.
But what the NASA traineeship did, it said, you don't do any teaching, you do all research.
Oh, wow.
So basically, and I got a lot of jokes from my fellow students about, yeah, Jim, go study fish on the moon, you know. They're just jealous.
Mm.
But what it amounted to, I find out one afternoon, Bo comes in and says, well, congratulations. You have been selected for the master traineeship in the biology department. And it's like, wow, you know, this is just blew me away. I was so excited. So I go home early, and I tell Anna, I said, okay, get one of our friends. We were in married student housing, so there's all these people to take care of the kids. And we swapped out babysitting duties, ladies did. And so I said, get a babysitter, we're going to go to dinner tonight. And and I celebrate my NASA traineeship. Oh, that's great. I said, I don't have to teach those damn labs. And said, oh, that's so wonderful. That's great. Well, about halfway through dinner, and things are going just great. We're all happy. And I said, you know, now that I don't have those labs to teach, I can go back to the biology department every night and work on those papers I've been trying to get finished up. And she said, what? I thought this meant you would stay home. So it's like, you know, I'm on one plane and she's on another.
Mm.
I'm looking at this like I've got all this time. I'm freed up now. No more grading lab papers. And no more setting up lab exams. And no more dealing with students and makeup tests and all that mess. I've got a wide open road to research. I can just work my buns off. You know, 8 days a week. And that's what I wanted to do. And Anna, bless her heart, was there thinking, oh, this means now that you don't have to teach labs, you'll be home every night.
Right.
With me and kids. Yeah, sure. No. It really, it went downhill in a hurry.
I was going to say, how did she handle it? Because it's...
Oh, and she was just disappointed. I mean... But
no, I mean, for 4 years, I mean, it's just nonstop. It's all consuming.
Totally all consuming. Yeah. But she was very supportive. I mean,
good for her.
She was and a lot of it, I'll be honest with you, it's amazing how tight knit the marriage student community was.
Okay.
And we only knew people in our surrounding apartments.
Yep.
But we get together on weekends to watch football games, drink, cook out. And if somebody needed to go somewhere and do something, they'd just stop at the house and say, hey, could you watch so-and-so for the next 4 or 5 hours? I'll be back. Oh, sure, yeah, drop him off here. And it was very easy. There are a lot of the women, wives that were basically in the same boat as Anna, because most of the students out there were were grad students that got married either when they graduated undergrad or early grad school, and that was it. So, but the apartment was $50 a month, and that paid for the apartment, 2-bedroom apartment, all utilities included.
Wow.
$50 a month. Yeah. Yeah. It was hard to beat. So I only had apartment rent every month, and I had a telephone bill, and that wasn't very much. It's a few dollars a month. We didn't call anybody long distance except I call my mom. I always called her late at night when it was cheaper, and usually once every couple of 3 weeks. And Anna's parents always called her. And they wasn't, an issue for them. But it's every now and then, I guess she would call her parents collect. She talked to her parents, my in-laws, a lot more than I did my mom, and she just called them collect. So.
And did, by this time, by 67, 68, 69, had your folks come around to you becoming a PhD?
Well, my dad actually passed away in December of 1963, before David was born, in 64. And, it was just a few days before Christmas. And so that left my mom at home with my younger brother, Nick, Drew Nicholson Jr. And it was, mom was so focused on taking care of herself and
right.
Nick that she didn't have time to worry about what I was doing.
Okay.
But I know if my dad had lived, he would have probably been on my case about it. And but mom was never, she just sort of wanted me out of school so I could, you know, I just be like my other brothers and sisters, so all out of college, married, and kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm married, I got a kid, but I'm in school.
Right. But you're still in school for 10 years.
I'm still in school, yes, for a long time.
What's wrong with you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Why aren't you finishing up? It's like, well, I'm still having fun and still learning stuff. It's great. It's it's fun to learn.
Yeah. And, yeah. No, it's you can just keep sucking it up. It's just really fun.
Yeah.
So I can appreciate that. So you graduated in 1969 with your PhD. Then what? Had you been thinking in 68 kind of what you were thinking about going to do?
Oh, yeah. It's very interesting. When I started my PhD program in 1965, you could pick up a copy of, there was a professional journal out then that was American Association of University Professors, AAUP.
Okay.
They had this monthly magazine. And in the back of it were all the job advertisements for PhDs.
Okay.
Or for, you know, sometimes masters and level or whatever. But anyway, there were job ads in there. And there were so many jobs at universities for zoologists. It's like in 65, 66 even, people would pick that up and they'd say, oh, look, here's an opening at the University of Wyoming. That sounds interesting. You know, I've never lived out west. And I talked to my wife about it. I think we're going to apply for a job out there.
Hmm.
And people just applied and there was never any question, and you just went. Well, between 65 and 69, that all changed. By 1969, their money was tight. There were no jobs for PhDs. I mean, it was bad. So what Bo did in the spring of 69, and he knew I was going to graduate in August 69, he started working on it, helping me out here. He went to the department chair and said, look, Jim's applied for a bunch of jobs because there's just nothing out there. And it's really, or the ones that are available, there's 25 people applying and at least one or two of them had friends in the department already.
Right.
Anyway, he went to the department chair in Alabama and said, is there any way we can keep him on? He will finish his dissertation. He'll defend, but he just won't turn his dissertation in, so he won't officially graduate. So he'll stay on in marriage, student housing, and we'll pay him, and he'll teach the general biology, at least some of the general biology lectures, Jones O. And they pretty much worked it out so that Bo told me, he said, don't worry too much about it. Just get your work done. He said, I've talked to the department chair, and you'll be able to stay on and teach general botany, Jones O labs. You'll be responsible for setting up the labs and managing grad students and that sort of thing. And probably filling in with lectures when professors are going to take off. And I thought, well, okay, that's good. But I, at that point, was not planning on turning in my dissertation. I was going to do everything, go ahead and defend it, but then it has to go to the graduate school office, and if I sit on it, I don't graduate.
Okay.
So we had it all worked out. And so at the last minute, there was a job opened up at Belmont College in Nashville, Tennessee.
Hmm.
And Belmont College at that time it's now, I guess, state-supported school, but at that time it was a Baptist college.
Okay.
And I've been born and raised in Baptist church, but I had not attended church for a long, long time. And I had long hair. I mean, most males did then. I actually had hair. I don't now. But anyway, I had long hair, and so I got, this was in about May, end of May, somewhere along in there, 1st of June, and the job was chairman of the department and full professor. It's like, wow, that's I got a lot of teasing from my fellow grad students. Damn, Jim's going out. He's going to be a department chair his first year out. Really. I'm only going to be an assistant professor, maybe. Anyway, I go up to interview. Before I went up to interview, I got myself a haircut and cleaned my act up and got my Sunday best on. And I interviewed, and that went well. And I thought, wow, this is going to be great because driving up there, it's like, man, all these streams I haven't sampled, it's got these neat fish in it. And I was almost thinking I was going into another, PhD program or something. I didn't realize what a hellhole I was getting into.
Oh, wow.
And so I got the job. And so I told him I'd be there at the end of August, and school started the first week of September at that time. And so Ann and I packed up our belongings after I finished up my dissertation, turned it in, graduated. And at the end of August, it was probably the 25th of August, so I had about a week before I had to be on campus at Belmont College in Nashville. So we called a real estate agent, and, at that time, there's no, you can't get online and look at what's available for housing.
Oh,
and,
yeah, right.
Anna found this house that was, the real estate agent sent us a picture in the mail, and it was a place to rent. And the person we were renting it from might want to sell it, depending on, how interested you were in buying and that sort of thing. And it's like, well, I'm not sure we'll rent for the first year. And so we have a place to live. We load up in a U-Haul trailer because we didn't have very much. Because in fact, we didn't have anything. Most of the furniture in the apartment we were renting belonged to the University of Alabama. It was a furnished apartment.
Oh, interesting.
But we had a few, like, chest of drawers for the kids, and it was really things where we had baby furniture, but we didn't have, we only had a couple pieces of adult furniture, rocking chairs and things like that we got. And we had all the pots and pans, obviously, but it was a pretty barren sort of, most of the move went for like this was my books and stuff. And so we get up there and get moved in, get settled, and I found out right away what the deal was. There was like four people in the apartment, and I was the fifth one. One of them was a PhD that had been there about 2 years, 3 years. He's a microbiologist. Another PhD had been there for maybe 3-4 years, and he's a physiologist. And then there was a retired guy there that had been department chair at University of Western Kentucky, but just didn't want to, he didn't want any administrative duties. He said, I love biology. That's why I got into biology. He said, I just want to teach. And he said, Jim, don't treat me any differently than anybody else. I just want to be one of your guys, he was great. And then there was another guy there that had a master's degree that was sort of jack of all trades on a lot of things, or filled in a lot of gaps. And then myself teaching zoology. And so I found out that they brought me in because they were worried about picking one of the other two PhDs that were already there because they didn't want to tick them off by picking one over the other.
Okay.
They brought me out from the outside and ticked both of them off.
Okay.
But it worked out all right. We basically, I think I'm a good enough people person that I like to think I am anyway, but we all got along. It all worked out. But the dean pretty much told me, well, we didn't want to pick one of them over the other because they were worried about the friction, so we just brought you in from the outside. It's like,
Fair enough.
Yeah. Tick them both off. But,
so,
yeah, that was, I stayed there a year, but it was, oh,
so hang on, wait. I'm looking at the time here, thinking we've been going along at great guns here for Not quite an hour, but we're getting there.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series, and next time you're going to tell us why Belmont wasn't such a bell of a place.
Yeah, I can do that. I can do that.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to add in the material you've just covered that you were thinking as we went along? Oh, I should mention that.
Grad school, I think that pretty much covers it.
Okay.
And
your second child hasn't been born yet, is that right?
Yeah. Anna's pregnant with the next one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, let's conclude part two.
All right.
Of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Williams. We'll get to the Grand Canyon, I promise.
Okay.
And today is Friday, August 27th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. And Jim, thank you so very much.
Yeah, totally enjoyed it. Thank you.